title might be interesting to some. Rutgers University has a number of glider autonomous underwater vehicles, or AUVs, and they get extensive press. And I think that there is reason faculty, students, engineers, and computer engineering might be interested in understanding the difference between that type of vehicle and another vehicle that Rutgers has that is available. And they really behave differently. They're used in different niches of sciences. And so it's, I think, I'll get into it. I think you'll find it interesting. So what I'm going to do in the talk is outlined here. I'm going to introduce you first, just for a general picture, to the diversity of autonomous underwater vehicles. I don't want this just to be about the one propelled vehicle that we have. That'll also get a chance to talk about how it differs from a glider and why. And then I'll talk specifically about the Rutgers Remus 100 that we have and its payload. I'll talk about how it gets used, and I'll talk about payload control, which is a recent addition to this vehicle and something that Raul Schoen worked on with me. And then I'll talk about access to the vehicle for those of you that are interested to it. An AUV is an autonomous underwater vehicle. It is not to be confused with a remotely operated vehicle. So that also makes it different than, for instance, an aerial drone that that you pilot. You do not pilot an AUV. You write code for it and you send it on its way and you go away and you pick it up sometime later. And in that sense, the propelled version that I'm going to be talking about is even a little bit different than a glider, because a glider regularly sees human intervention for its piloting, and that's not the case on these. Just some acronyms. AUV is an autonomous underwater vehicle. ROV is remotely operated vehicle. UAV is commonly unmanned aerial vehicle, and that can be either remotely piloted or autonomous, but still UAV. And then UAV and UVV are just wavelengths.
All the perturbations.
Yeah. And those latter have nothing to do with vehicles. They just are. What do AUVs do for us? Well, generally the same thing as robots in general, which are dull and dangerous jobs, but you can add for AUVs a dirty, dull, or deep. These are put in places where humans do not want to go, or where tedium is such that it's not efficient for people to do it. For instance, just the open ocean, which is just blue and blue and blue and looks empty. You can see that from the image that I have here of the vehicle working under ice, this is a really good indication of kind of the niche, or an example of the niche of an AUV, a propelled AUV working. If you're studying, for instance, fish under the ice, or studying the oceanography of the water under the ice, or even the ice surface, the formation of the ice underneath, and you took a ship through the ice, you cracked the ice and disturbed that in kilometers, potentially in all directions. Whereas an AUV, you need only a small hole, you can put it under there. It can go out there, look at the underneath surface of the ice, look at the environment, the fish underneath it, come back. The other neat thing is that it co-locates sensors. So if you're looking at, as I do, I'll keep coming back to fish, but if you're looking at fish biology and you want to understand the environment of that fish, you take the sensor down to the fish, but the other sensors about the environment are down there with the fish also, as opposed to things that happen on the surface when you are towing one sensor and or a package. An example of AUVs in the news. This was a Remus AUV that found the Air France flight that took off from Brazil towards Europe and was lost. And it did find it. AUVs were used extensively in the search for the missing Malaysian airliner that so far has not been found, but they found a lot of different stuff down there. These AUVs can go down, big ones that you see there can go down and stay for an order of a day or so underwater.
Is the side scan sonar on the sides?
Yeah, I'll talk about more about the side scan sonar in particular, and that's a beautiful lead into this thing here, because we're going to talk about the difference between active gliders, active swimmers, and gliders. And it turns out that the payload is a really important consideration there. So it's hard to get a picture of an AUV, an active swimmer underwater. And this is the worst possible, but we got the shot anyways. But there's a propeller here, and that's the part that got cut off. What you see on the active swimmer, it's different on the glider, where you can see the whole thing and you know there is no propeller. There are wings here. So the glider works. It's barely buoyant on the surface, but it sips in about a cup of water on the surface by closing down the space in a piston that compresses that air. So it becomes just negatively buoyant and it begins to sink. And as it sinks, the pressure builds up underneath the wings. And a small motor moves the battery forward so that it tips forward. Now the pressure escapes out from the back side of the wings, pushes the glider forward as it falls. Same thing as a flying glider. When it gets near the bottom, it spits that cup of water out. Battery case rolls back, so it tips this way, starts to float to the surface. Again, the pressure builds up on the top of the wings, this time instead of the bottom, and it spills out the back and pushes it forward, so it yo-yos. It has to go up and down in order to go forward. It can't go forward without going either up or down. Otherwise, it's just going to sit there. And because of that, it's fairly slow, too. And that's very different than the swimmer AUV, which acts like a torpedo. And because of that, it can get down at a fixed height over the bottom, for instance, or a fixed height below the surface. There can be multiple rules of priority on how that gets figured out. It can also go up and down if it wants, or if you want it to, you can tell it to do that. It can do many different configurations underwater while it's swimming. So that's a precision tool. It really, really acts very differently than a glider does. And we'll get into what that means for the science and potentially for people interested in this when we talk more about payload. Before I get to payload, I just quickly wanted to survey AUV designs in general. Those are two kind of endpoints. It's actually a third endpoint, which is autonomous surface vehicles. But these are some of the risks associated with AUVs in general and some of the engineering solutions. They include mechanical engineering solutions and they include algorithmic solutions. And that means things like how you have an AUV deployed, what kind of path it follows when it's doing the work, and also computational challenges to how the sensors work and how you use them when they're deployed and you don't get a readout of what they're doing because they truly are autonomous. Remember that these things could be very deep below the surface, and so you can't send large data streams back and look at these things in real time. There's some low frequency and mid-range frequency communications and high range frequency communications available, but they're pretty limited. Certainly not something that sends high frequency side scan sonar data back to the surface. So a quick survey. Some of the endurance vehicles. Now, endurance vehicles are the vehicles on the side of the spectrum like gliders. They require very, very low battery. That also limits the payload control, but they can stay out for weeks or months as opposed to hours. So here's one that has a solar array to it. Some of these things are used for even like spying missions, what they call sneak and peek missions. They can go in and erect a radio mast and listen to
vessel traffic in foreign ports, meaning vessel radio traffic. Deep submergence, this one is for very fine positioning over very deep reefs, and it actually has fins that can scull and allow very fine positioning. It's just a quick view of your standard torpedo-shaped vehicle. You'll notice this one has no fins. This one is thrust vectored. So you turn the whole propeller, shrouded. And that really deals with a vulnerability on fins, right? Rahul, we dropped the $500,000 Remus on the deck and broke the fins when we were in Alaska, and we had to have a replacement part flown in by float plane from Massachusetts. It was very expensive. It's not the first time that happened in Alaska, but as you saw in the earlier engineering chart, that's one of the big risks is the fins sticking out. These are there's a number of vehicles that are designed. This one's modular here, which is really neat because you can reconfigure for different missions. But I should have put this together with the last. There are a lot of vehicles that are built with hulls, and including tandem hulls side by side or also up and down, and these minimize things like pitch and roll. When you're doing work, for instance, with the downward-looking acoustic current Doppler profiler, where you really, really want to minimize your roll, or where you're doing photography over the bottom. Yes?
Do you counter-rotate the propeller?
Yeah, you can counter-rotate
those. In normal trans do you? No, I guess you couldn't.
Those you could use those and or this, but you also can... They're probably counter-rotating. I don't know this machine, but
okay.
They're probably counter-rotating for
quick turn.
For a quick turn. And also opposite vector, you mean. All kinds of stuff like that. I'll finish the survey with two interesting autonomous surface vehicles. This is the Liquid Robotics Wave Glider. It actually is a surfboard, so it surfs down on the surface of a wave, and it has this pendulum underwater that swings behind it and then catches up, and it surfs again and catches up and surfs again with that pendulum. And the way that the pendulum actually works is that the finlets on it are configured one way when it's allowed to come forward, and then they turn this way and stop it, and so it acts like a ratchet. And so these things are really great for explorations of surface water, but they are bound to the surface. They're not underwater vehicles.
And relatively slow, I would imagine.
Yes, but they can transit oceans, you know, do surface measurements. And another autonomous sailboat, and there's a number of these designs, most of them with rigid sails. And they have equipment up in the sail, too, sensors for wind measurements. But there's some really neat algorithms in learning to actually steer these things and self-right them when they get tumbled and stuff like that. Okay. We'll
question.
Talk about.
I'm just curious. You showed one on the first one was the one with the solar panels.
Yeah.
Right? These are to be designed for long
endurance missions, right?
What does it do with biofouling? I mean, do you have any?
It's an issue. I think that's an experimental one. I expect that you get biofouling of the solar panels. Biofouling in general is an issue in all the marine industries too, and it's generally solved by materials. So you cover that with some material that hopefully doesn't cut too much sunlight out. Oh, sorry, we're back here. This is the vehicle that we use. It is manufactured by Hydroid Incorporated, which is recently purchased by Kongsberg, big company that makes autopilots and stuff like that, and their own AUVs. But this one is the Remus 100 model. It's called a person portable model. It's about 87 pounds or so, 40 some kilos. So one person can lift it, though we deploy it with two. You can see it has a propeller, fins for going up and down, left to right, controlling pitch, roll, yaw. Sensor packages. It can do a path up to about 55 kilometers long at speed 2 to 4 knots. Top speed is 5 knots. But if you're going 5 knots, you are using up the battery so fast that you can't do the longest trip. And if you are going really slow, you use up the battery for the hotel load before you get. So the sweet spot is about 3 knots, which is what, 1.8 meters per second or something. And it's precision, right? It's very good at maintaining height and position in the water. So we've had it running for up to 14-hour missions, and of course, how the vehicle is configured affects that somehow. You can get a recharge to 75% in about 6 hours, 100% in 12 hours, because the charge slows down. So you can plan this depending on what your mission is. You may only want to charge it to 75%, put it back in the water, and you get faster rotation that way and more time in the water. Number of ways to launch it, including off of large ships. Talk a little bit more about how it works. Here is Joe, our pilot, general programmer, working on it when it's sitting there in the case prior to a mission. So you type code into it. There is some newer virtual interface programs with drag and drop type coding, but generally we prefer to code it and see the code. So you write it in, upload it to the vehicle, unplug it, you can bench test it, and then you put it in the water and let it go. Pick it up, download it.
Do you guys have simulators for these things, kind of to develop code?
There is a simulator available. There's one that's owned by Lockheed Martin, I think, and then there's one owned by the maker, but
it's not a product.
But there's at least a mission check in the VIP. So before you put it in the water, it goes through a number of checks, including warnings about it potentially running into land if you have the program path over land surfaces. And we've written some simulators to look at work, but they're not hooked up to the machine. They're just, you know, programs running to look at different mission paths and stuff like that. Okay. How does it know where it's going? So a number of different ways. Dead reckoning is one method. It's counting prop revolutions or speed, a direction. It has an internal compass. One way of telling speed is if it's close enough to the bottom, the acoustic current Doppler profiler, which is Doppler sonar, instead of radar, if that's on the bottom, that is it. We're jumping ahead here between sensors in this, but it's confounded. So there's an upward looking acoustic current Doppler profiler and a downward looking one. When you use those for water motion, studying 3D water motion around the vehicle, those are called acoustic Doppler profilers. When you use them for vehicle navigation, you use the term DVL or Doppler velocity logger. So it can tell from programming the hard contact signal of the bottom as opposed to particulates in the water. So when it's focused on particulates in the water, it's measuring water motion. When it gets that hard contact that knows its bottom, it can then tell that relative to the motion of the vehicle. So if it's heading on a zero of 20 degrees, but there is a current pushing it to the left, it knows that and corrects for that and crabbing a little bit to keep itself on path. And that's actually very, very accurate. The Navy did a 35-kilometer track underwater.
They had a marker buoy set up for, you know, to know where to look for it when it came up. And after 35 kilometers on dead reckoning, it came up, surfaced, and pretty much kissed the buoy and just came to a stop right there. And we've done something similar in Lake Erie. You can enhance that by coming up for checks with the GPS. Now, the vehicle internally is measuring its dilution of precision on a number of different aspects, and it will actually, if it thinks it's lost, it will come up for a GPS fix on its own. But you can program those, override them, have them more or less frequent.
How long do you run? Is ADCP always running?
The ADCP is always running. It's considered an important part. Now, we've run this in water 500-600 meters deep, where it can't get bottom locked because we're running at 86 meters and it's gotten lost and come up much more frequently. Not lost, but it knows it's lagging and it comes up and checks. Trilateration is where you have a number of beacons in different flavors of frequency. They're acoustic, so they're sitting down there typically in a moored survey location, and it's called a ranger. So the AUV actually sends a message to that, requests a return signal and gets it and computes the distance between each of them by the time of travel of the signal on multiple ones. It can use just one, but two, and configurations.
It's like GPS underwater.
Yeah, it works the same way, right? Well, GPS is receiving only, but close, yeah. Right? So trilateration in any case, and check. Now, there are vehicles and inertia that have this, and they are options on this vehicle. They're no longer an option on our vehicle because our vehicle is full. So we cannot put an inertial navigation system in it, but that's basically a gyroscope that spins and tells you if you have a flash. Short baseline transducers go on the nose cone and can be used to guide the vehicle into, for instance, docking home ports so that it doesn't have to surface. Those are very useful for military missions where you never want a surface expression at all. You just want to come in and dock. And they have been used in other applications and science applications to guide the vehicle to other packages. We had that. We took it off because we needed a different sensor on ours. So let's look at the vehicle that we have set up. Again, here is the prop. Oh, control surfaces. I wonder if that's on the timer. So propulsion and control up here. This is a GPS antenna. It also helps you find the vehicle when it's on the surface because it's kind of orange, a little blinker light there. This is the side scan transducer. So this is a 600 kilohertz. There's a rail on each side of it, and it's looking to the side. Actually, very frequently you'll see cartoons of side scan where it's like a fan looking down to the side, and that's typical of a ship side scan or towed vehicle near the surface. But in actuality, it's semi-lobed, and it covers, and you will see objects above the vehicle as well. So it's a fan spread like that. And that has really important implications, it turns out, to us when we're studying fish. Here is the upward looking ADCP, the downward looking ADCP. This right here unit is the transducer for communications, so acoustic communications. Pretty low level stuff like abort, where are you, what's your status? Come home. And then a number of other sensors that don't show in here. There's a oxygen sensor. So oxygen works on light. So it's pulsing blue light that excites oxygen molecules. It's looking for fluorescence of oxygen molecules returning. CTD is conductivity for salinity, temperature, and depth. And that also is used in corrections for sound speed or sound velocity underwater for the other things like the ADCP. So also chromatic dissolved organic materials, chlorophyll A. That's an important pigment in algae. And CDOM is another pigment in water. And those are optical sensors as well.
And then here we have replaced the standard nose cone with a hydrophone that listens to tags, so acoustic transmitters that are coded in code division multiple access. Okay, so CDMA code, what's used on your cell phone cable and whatnot to encode information. This lets it listen to particular transmitters that you surgically implant in fish, let the fish go. You could have many fish. There's 80,000 available codes. You can have 100 of them in a bucket with echo and everything, and it can tell them apart, just like your cell phone's pretty good at telling things apart. So even at very high frequency repeat rates of 2 seconds, you can set those transmitters up at different rates. And that is manufactured by Low-Tech. That is a standard moored receiver that gets put underwater as an easy pass system, kind of for watching the migration of fish. So these fish, as they migrate up and down the coast or different oceans, they get detected by these. You can also have them on a boat and follow them. But what we've done is put the hydrophone on there and send it looking for fish. So the standard model is that you go and you search an area and you look for fish. It is omnidirectional. So if it hears a tag within about a kilometer on either side, it will log that that tag is there. But that's presence absence. Okay, so you have plus or minus a kilometer on either side ahead or behind the vehicle. But you can get a collection. For instance, if those are pinging every 5 seconds, you get a collection of those hits.
Can I ask a quick question? What is the energy? I mean, 1.2 kilowatts for a glider guy, that's mind-blowing.
Right.
How much of this is propulsion?
Most of it.
I guess that.
Yeah. I can't tell exactly, but I'd say it's mission dependent. I think the second most, well, the acoustics are also energy expensive. So the transducer and the ADCP, and then actually the communications modem actually sucks battery. So we get, and if we use that infrequently, we'll get another half hour out of a 10-hour mission.
So it's like 85 to 90%.
Yeah. Yep. And then the other stuff. So the Low-Tech thing is just a moored hydrophone that we knocked off the battery pack. We gave the power supply to a guest port, but sending it through a DC-DC converter to quiet any electrical noise in there, because the board there for the CDMA processor is very sensitive to noise. So now it has a very quiet power pack. There are other units that we put on completely parasitic loads, like Vemco receivers that carry their own D cell, and you just strap it to the bottom.
What about processing? What's the control processor like? Are these off the shelf things?
Or, yeah. So this hydrophone has its own CDMA processor in there. And the AUV navigation is generally completely proprietary. Now, this is an important thing that I'm going to talk about next here, because there's a bridge now. So you can set up payload control, and that's available. And we've, in fact, developed payload control to do to work with this. So this is what the side scan looks like. Right here, imagine this vehicle, running like this, and you're getting a top-down view. And remember that I said it kind of sees all the way up to the side. So it's sending out a ping, getting an echo, another one, and it's collecting those in lines of 520 pixels across or so. Right here, up the center, this is where the AUV is hearing itself ring. So the left transducer is hearing the right transducer. Then there's a space, because there's nothing, that's water, before the first signal hits the bottom and comes back. So if you take a piece of paper and fold it like this and have the AUV at the top, in the beginning there's nothing but water, unless there's fish in the water or something, you'll see that. So you're taking that and you're spreading that 3D picture out like this. Okay. The Nyquist function, you're mapping that 2D into 3D. So that's why you're getting this. If you want to make a true map out of this and marry these pictures with the other ones in line and make a mosaic, you have to cut this section out and weld these two pieces of the track together, and then you'll get them georectified for the most part. Okay. Then this ripple right here is the first reflection of the surface. You can see there's waves. So you can tell how far the vehicle is above the bottom here and how far it is below the surface. For instance, you can tell right here it's about it's 3 meters or so from the bottom, and it's about 6 to 8 meters below the surface, fairly shallow water. These are sand ripples. There are boundaries between two different geoforms in the sand. That's a shipwreck. You can see that when you're lower, and the purpose of side scan is that you exaggerate the acoustic shadows. Just like if you're walking early in the morning, you have a long shadow because the sun is low. If you're up high, it's your shadow is right underneath you, and you don't see it. And in fact, that region is called the nadir right here. You're right underneath it, and you don't have much shadow. So if you see something that is not attached to a shadow, just like when you jump, your shadow detaches from you. That's above the bottom. So this is a survey of short-nosed sturgeon, which are a critically endangered species. This is up near Trenton in the Delaware River. Here you can see a number of these fish. They're hovering just above the bottom. This is just after ice out, and they're waiting to spawn. These fish are about a half a meter to a meter long or so. And this is where, and there's more of these fish here, and this is where, these are sand waves, this is where a buoy, anchored buoy, was caught in the ice and dragged, a big navigation buoy. So it plowed a furrow into the bottom.
How do you know that this is this particular fish? You use that as information, you know that's kind of...
Yeah, actually, and I'll talk about the sensor fusion. In this case, we were tracking fish that had transmitters on, got into this, got a bunch of them, but we can do even better than that. And that's where the payload control information will come in. I'll get to that. Before I do, let's just talk about the bottom a little bit more. This might be interesting to some of you. So this regards supervised classification and or unsupervised classification. An example here is where we did a survey of the bottom off of Sandy Hook, New Jersey, the National Park Service. Their property extends underwater and it's never been surveyed. So looking for artifacts of anthropogenic interest, cultural interest, but also biological resources. So you have side scan all over here. We took grab samples and photography of the bottom to get sediment, did cluster analysis and canonical correspondence analysis and PCA to assign different types of habitat based on the sediment characteristics, the depth, the organic load, the sediment size, and also the animals that were in it, and put them together into a supervised classification algorithm and then produce a habitat map. In this case, that's all soft bottom. Differentiation was between muds, silts and sands and gravelly sands. So not really diverse, but one thing that we really struggled with, for instance, is that you have loose things like there's collections of smashed oyster shell or mussel shell on top of the sands or on top of the muds, and they're mobile, but they have a very similar acoustic signature to gravels. And it's really on the opposite end of the spectrum and holds different animals than gravels do. So we found that when we broke this down into two different sections, we could clear that up. There's issues with fish. This is brand new. This is from a paper that we had in 2015 on classification of fishes from side scan sonar. So because you're up in the 600 or even 900 kilohertz range for some vehicles, this one's 600. You can actually see individual animals. So you can see a thing like a manta ray here, and you can actually see the cephalic fins, and you can see the tail here. But there's a lot of things that you get that are dots, but they have particular arrangements that that speak to behaviors of those animals that may help you classify them. There's a number of different stingrays, and we wrote an algorithm there using object symmetry, object symmetry distribution to classify rays, and it was very, very good. An undergraduate student wrote that algorithm for me as a REU student. I was doing fish work. She said she wanted to work on the sonar. Absolutely. and that was published. You have other things that, like I said, the arrangement of the fishes in particular, these are fence rows. These are predatory fish. You see them arranged like traveling geese. You know how geese are always flying in those V's? This is a little interesting side story, but you know how that V is always longer on one side? Like they're asymmetrical. You know where that, why that is? There's more geese on one side. That's it. all there is to it. Actually, they're switching out all the time. And so if you have an even number of birds, one side has to be longer than the other. Right? And so it's just a probability thing. Once in a while, you'll see them briefly symmetrical.
This analysis that you're doing, is this meant for real time? So for instance, that you want to kind of follow something, or is it postmodern?
Right now, it's post-processing, but yes, I would very much like to get into real time, and that's why I'm here. I can't do that, but I suspect that a number of you could. So yeah, I'm looking for collaborations, but beyond collaborations, this is not my vehicle. People call, I work with it, and people call it mine because I work with it, but it's not mine. I'll get into that in access. Anybody's welcome to use it. It has a user fee, but it's like chartering a vessel. These things, you look at these fish, and they're like, we get fish that are like kilometers long, of course, or fish that are, they look like they're 20 meters long if you measure them. But of course, no, that's not happening. This is when a fish is pacing you. So it turns out that a lot of fish are interested in the vehicle and they're swimming alongside it. And I got in, like we were getting these and I wasn't seeing anything on camera. So I jumped in the water to go diving and here's these big fish. And they swim right alongside you. So they stay as you're pinging here on it and then it moves with you. And you can see that from their shadows, their acoustic shadows here, that they're doing this, they're braiding themselves around the vehicle as they swim. And so those are behavioral characteristics that that may be belong to certain species of fish or certain groups of fish, like predatory fish versus prey fish. And even those kinds of characters could potentially be used in writing algorithms. Of course, fish aren't static. They change, and what they do one time may be different than another. Some of these fish have, this is right here in the Hudson River. These are sturgeon. A lot of people don't know that the Hudson River is the last remaining stronghold for spawning Atlantic sturgeon. They get to about 4 meters in length, and they certainly can carry acoustic tags. And what we were doing here was tagging them to look at their use of the spawning grounds, but we found that we could, in fact, see a particular fish that we had tagged. So we're like, oh, we could do ground truthing here. But we need to know the position of this fish in potentially meter scale resolution to be able to say that's the fish that's carrying our tag. Now, remember that we have this big margin of error on positioning of the fish and where it is. And that's something that's really important. We were looking at, in general, the behavior of the AUV relative to, how much time do I have left? Okay. Try to speed up here. Really quick, the AUV is much, much better at finding, the AUV is in black, and a ship comparatively is in gray at detections of transmitters. The AUV is much better at detecting deep transmitters and even shallow transmitters, probably because there's no line loss with the hydrophone, but especially because the hydrophone is down at depth where the fish are. So if you think of a transmitter with a 600 meter range or so, And then it's in 600 meters. There's this expanding bubble of sound that comes up that dies out just about the surface in a ship that's at tangent exactly to that sphere has a very slim possibility of hearing it. Whereas if you go down even a little ways and run a cord through that hemisphere, then you have a much better chance you're in range of that transmitter much longer. And it's quieter down there. So essentially here is a typical mapping by timestamps. You make some detections up here, and so you know the sturgeon are there. But that can be greatly improved. I'm going to skip through this, examples of how we use this. This is the sound pressure level. And from that, you can kind of figure out where the fish was, but you can actually map the sound pressure level through that. But the problem is this will always give you a solution that is right on the track, because wherever the AUV makes the highest sound pressure is where that surface of that's going to be. So that's suboptimal also. The fish could easily be somewhere in between there. So what we really want to do is synthetic aperture. So synthetic aperture, you're probably quite familiar with in the sonar and radar applications. This one is different because the sound source and receiver are decoupled. So in sonar, it sends out and it gets a time back, and the distance is known from that. And then by moving, it can paint a 3D picture of that. This application of synthetic aperture does not paint a picture. Instead, it hears tag. This tag has a precision on the timing of the repeat of the tag of about 5 or 6 decimal places to the second. Okay? So if you hear the tag at 5 second intervals, and you proceed along the track, and now you hear it 4.9989, you've gotten closer to the tag. And as you pass it, that gets longer again. Now you have a bimodal resolution. You know when you pass the tag. Oh, now it's getting longer again. I've passed the tag. But that's bimodal. Now if you turn, you can resolve that bimodality. And if you have a couple of turns, you can resolve that even better, right? So you're going along, it gets quieter, or it gets not quieter, shorter, longer, and then you turn and it gets even shorter, or it gets shorter again, you know you've turned towards the tag, and that's the side that the tag is on, and that resolves your bimodality. And that's the synthetic aperture. Okay, this is the typical path of an AUV that's doing vertical, or that's doing bottom mapping. See, and you have a lot of vertical exaggeration here, and the squigglies here are the bottom following to get a good map. And these kind of patterns, what we call lawn mowing or Boutrophedon search patterns, where it's absolutely linear on the top, they don't provide for good positioning algorithms unless you happen to be at one of the corners. What you want to do is have a vehicle move when it detects a tag. So we recently got this installed on our, so there's a guest computer on there now. It's a Windows XP machine. It's running the detections for the low-tech receiver, the tag receiver. When it hears a tag, it processes the tag, runs this synthetic aperture override maneuver, and sends the commands to the navigation computer, which is proprietary. And this is through RS-232, the company released this protocol. Now, there's not that many things you can do with an AUV. You can make it go faster, slower, up, down, turn left, turn right at desired angles, and go at desired speeds. You know, pretty simple stuff. So those are a series of commands that you send and receive between the guest computer and the proprietary navigation. So you put in your survey mission like a Boutrophedon pattern, but now when you hear a tag, you can ask a number of things. What does this tag belong to? So I look up on a library, and I ask, is this a crab that's moving slowly, or is it a shark that's moving fast? Given one or the other, I can pick a maneuver that's appropriate to the speed or behavior of that animal. Perhaps write a template or get a loaded template. At this point, we're using loaded templates, preloaded templates that are assigned to certain tags or even ignore a tag. How close are we to the tag? We don't know because we don't have position, but we do have sound pressure levels, so we can make an initial assessment of how close we are to the tag and if we should bother pursuing an override maneuver. We see if this tag, if we've already acted on it, because we don't want to get caught in this loop where we're still on one tag and there's other tags to be searched. So put global and local tag override coolers on it, and you're going to release it from that. Okay. You're going to look at the position relative to exclusion zones and the launch. So if I put it in the water and it sees a tag right away, or it hears a tag right away, it could turn and run into the boat, and you don't want to do that. Likewise, if you're transiting these narrow fjords like we have in Alaska, you don't want to run it into the wall of the fjord if it detects a fish there. So if things check out, then it gives an okay, and it hooks out into one of the maneuvers. And based on work that we did with Rahul, the best, at least simple maneuver is using a graph search design, given the constraints that we had, was this forward isosceles triangle or lateral triangle. We're going to break left, we're going to cut across the track, come back, and then continue on our mission and ignore that tag. You can see that this works really well. This is actually one mission. It's launched here. It goes around this course with reference tags twice. So in green, it's listening to detections from one tag on one mooring, and the red on another. And here you can see detections, but they're inside the exclusion zone. And so it's not executing any override maneuvers. Over here it is, the first tag detection. It's breaking into an override maneuver. And when you see these lined up here on top of each other, that's the second leg, like an hour later when it's coming back. But you can see that those are executed at very, very similar positions, because there is some repeatability to that check on sound pressure level that gives you some confidence about what the vehicle is going to do and when. And that's really important, because you want to be able to let this vehicle go underwater, know the total time limit that it could potentially be out there, which you can calculate from how many maneuvers you could get out of the number of distributed tags. So you have a boundary of when the vehicle is going to be at its pickup point, and you know that it can't wander out of the area. There are other AUVs that chase fish, sharks, and they'll go where that shark goes. You don't know where that shark is going. So you have to babysit the AUV the entire way. And if you're going to do that, you might as well be chasing it with the boat. At least that's how I see it. The code for this payload override sailover is available on GitHub now, free of, just pick it up. But it's 2,000 lines of code approximately, running on four threads. There's a main thread, a tag listener thread. This is basically processing the low-tech data in terms of which tag we have. Keep alive thread, these are required by the vehicle, by the vehicle system, and there's the mutexes to make sure that it's it doesn't crash.
I missed that. That's running on the
on the guest computer. Okay. Yep. And so then it's just sending when it gets an execute maneuver, it's writing a simple text line. Now the thing about this is that it is doing these, so a programmer, like a biologist, does not need to know how to run this program in terms of what's going on under the hood. They simply provide, for instance, a text file of a tag and template maneuver. If you see tag 1301, assign it to maneuver one. If you see tag 1302, assign the template maneuver, maybe a smaller triangle or so, because it's a crab. This is all just drop and drag in a Windows environment. You drop these tag assignments to a file. You can drop you can change those templates. They're not hard. They don't have to be that triangle. That's what was good for us. But you can write any maneuver as simply a departure that you want to make from the current direction of travel, So an angle and a duration you want to run that leg, what you want to do next. So you just put in a series of angles of departure and how long you want that particular thing to run, and a depth and a speed. So very simple text. You just drop it into the folder, and then you can run it and see what it's going to look like on the simulator. So that's a good starting point if you wanted to alter, if you wanted to write your own vehicle code. There are overrides that belong to the proprietary system that you can't see. It has priority. It can reject a command. So for instance, if the battery is low and it's telling to execute, it says, no, I'm keeping my command on top. Okay, so basically this vehicle is treated like a vessel asset. Rutgers has a number of vessels, from the big 44-foot, 47-foot coastal vessels to a number of smaller ones, skiffs that are available at different rates, but you take it on a ship too. So it's treated just like a vessel. It would come, if you chartered a vessel to do work, it would come with a captain, unless you have your own license to run it. So this is treated the same way. Anybody can rent this AUV out. You can rent it out to put it on the bench. You can rent it out for applied missions. You could put it in the water, non-applied missions, meaning missions that you want to test out code that you have. You can use it for doing development on machine learning. So not the vehicle itself, but it happens to be a platform with sonar. So if you want to work on sonar and you want real life applications of sonar in the real actual challenging conditions that you find them in, do that. You look at sensor fusion, whatever. You would just say that you want to use the vehicle. It has a splash fee. Probably past that. So here's the fee structure. It's $2,000 for basically a splash. So if you're going to have it out all day, which is a daily mission, if the mission aborts for some reason, you pick it up and you have to relaunch it, you don't get recharged that again. You know, your planned mission. If somebody is writing the mission for you, the standard mission that you're going to be running on, for instance, you're looking at sonar and don't care about the algorithms running the vehicle, or you have an algorithm you want to run on the vehicle, but you want somebody experienced to write that code, the basic program first, that tells the AUV where it's going, that's $600 a day. That's not assessed again. Like if you're doing repeats, you're going to one place and you're running a mission over and over. That's just once. That's assessed once. Data preparation. So this is when you download the data and one of us will download it and hand it to you and graph out the basics, the mission characteristics, the sonar and everything like that. Bench fees, I think, are $50 a day. That's not nailed down. But for instance, if you wanted this on your bench for a week because you were dry running algorithms, for instance, when you test the payload control, you give it a stimulus of some sort and you want to see that rudder run, you don't have to put it in the water for that and risk the machine. You just want to see the rudder turn. You want to see it abort if you think it's going to abort, et cetera. So that's available.
Any penalty for losing it?
So it is insured, and that's one of the reasons I'm here. So the vehicle, we pay about $20,000 a year insurance on it. So it does us no good sitting on the bench. We're looking for an insurer that will do a per splash, but right now it's insured through Rutgers, and even if it never goes in the water and it's not generating any money, we have to pay that insurance fee. But beyond that, this is just a tool that is available to people for development of programs related to the AUV and AUV application itself, but also quite aside from that, if you're looking for challenges, real life challenges on sensor development, sensor reading, machine learning, path programming, all those kinds of things, and your proposal would be furthered by saying, we're actually going to do this instead of just run it on a simulator.
And that is very important to some funding agencies, such as, for instance, ONR. We've had Office of Naval Research funding here, and they very much want to see this running in the water. This lets you do it. So I don't have to be a collaborator. Like I said, it's not mine. I could be a collaborator if you have, if you want to know something, challenges about the marine environment or whatever, I'm happy to work with you. But you can also rent the vehicle quite aside from me and work just with the regular vehicle programmer to do what you need to do. And of course, the university has vessels. They have their own costs from $250 a day for a skiff if you're working near shore or an estuary or something like that. Big vessels for going to sea for weeks are NFS vessels. You compete for those like any NSF proposal. I think it's time to shut up, right? Like,
you spoke about simulators.
Yep.
And that they're proprietary. Are there any non-proprietary ones?
So I don't know enough about that. I know a few people have made their own. And that's not proprietary, of course. But you have to get them to share them. Like Lockheed Martin's is going to be proprietary, but I think they helped develop it for Hydroid. But you can buy them from Hydroid. Hydroid will make them for you. But we don't have.
But it seems a simulator right now. I mean, the gliders are the same thing. They have on the bench simulator.
Right.
It's an environment where you can basically run this thing dry.
Right. And we certainly, and the regular stock VIP package does have that in it. So you start it and it'll run the mission for you on the screen and go.
It's called real time simulation. It takes 1 hour.
Yeah, it is real time.
And if you do something wrong, you lose the vehicle.
Well, yeah. Another bench dog.
So we've lost the vehicle before, but we've recovered because you can find it with the acoustic communications. And also, what we started doing was putting a salmon radio tag on it. So the radio, as soon as the vehicle submerges, the radio signal gets cut off because salt water is ionic. So you lose that. But as soon as it resurfaces, you hear it on the ship, even from kilometers away. And with a Yagi antenna, you can go right to the stalled vehicle and find it. And, you know, we carry a 6-element Yagi antenna and find it. And that'll interrupt you. This is completely, like, if the vehicle's dead, whatever, it doesn't matter. When it surfaces, we'll be sitting on the deck of the vessel talking. All of a sudden, the radio thing will start beeping. It's like a ball peen hammer to the head, this click that comes from it.
Argos.
We don't have Argos on this. We tried to and had no room left on the board. Actually, we tried Iridium, and we couldn't get it. But this is just a simple, and it's externally mounted. You just strap it onto the outside, and you hear it from a completely redundant system. And then you look at your clock. Oh, was it supposed to come up for a GPS signal? No, it was not.
Oh, damn.
Wait for 2 minutes and see if it goes back down. If it doesn't, you go and get it.
Too many questions.
Yeah.
Lithium ion, I assume, is a battery, right? Rechargeable.
It's nickel cadmium.
Okay. But the problem normally is if you're rechargeable, it's very hard to see how much juice you have left.
So, yeah, these are smart batteries. You can log in and, in fact.
So basically, trust on what they're telling you.
Yes, but we calibrate them.
Okay.
And we condition the batteries if we haven't been using them and we check it. So it has readouts for each independent cell and stuff. And that's actually communicated through the acoustic modem while it's in mission also, if you want to know. The hardest thing about these batteries is traveling. When we go to Alaska, you know, that's hazmat, and the pilots will take it up to Alaska, and then the bush pilots are not union anymore for FedEx, and they can charge what they want. Some don't carry. Just put it in the back of the plane. They don't care. Other ones are very, you know, yeah. That costs, like, it costs us $2,000 to send it to Alaska.
You need whatever. And I know I tried once to think about these batteries, but then they told me I have to have whatever safety level.
Yeah.
I don't have real sandals in there anymore.
But yeah, we trust the readouts, but we condition them and cycle them before we're doing trips like that.
Old school.
Yeah.
So to summarize the opportunities in terms of collaborations, one is on the machine learning side, like detecting fish from the data.
Mm-hmm. Fish from the data. So there's my stuff. There's collaboration with what I'm interested in. Fish in terms of recognition algorithms for different fishes and different habitats, and also sensor fusion stuff. Mm-hmm. Also related to me, but really orthogonal to me, if you wanted to, is path planning. Right now we're doing both strophodon patterns or looking at a map. And for instance, if you're looking at fish, fish tend to cluster, and you may not just want to do the planned path. You may want to do a path that what predators do is levee flight. They'll do a run and tumble type searches where a tuna will transit long distances. They'll find this prey field and then they'll explore that locally until they deplete it, and then they'll take off again on a random, on a new random path. So
this is adaptive to the sensor.
Yes.
That you get
mm-hmm.
the
and then but also not like there's potentially even run and tumble paths that are not necessarily sensor driven. If you just need to understand scale in order to better plan a path, then you have to sample at the different scales. So you might do a run and tumble to get your initial state distribution kind of stuff. And that, like I said, that's completely orthogonal to, I mean, I'm interested in it for my reasons, but there could be somebody that's interested in the exact same thing for very different reasons, and you go exploring with that. Yeah.
And there is opportunity potentially, a third direction is just improving the system in terms of like the software.
So we can't do anything with the proprietary part of it,
yeah.
But yeah, there's that. And then the other one I would say is, again, orthogonal in my work is machine vision, multispectral cameras and how they act underwater and what they tell us. The sonar itself for both fish and bottom, again, orthogonal to me because I'm interested in fish, but somebody may be interested in sonar and how it acts and what it tells you. Quite aside from fish, just improving classification algorithms.
If you can send me, like perhaps on a page, some images, example of images and the data, like the ones you showed
sure.
here, I can share again with people that are more from the machine learning, machine vision
okay.
side.
Yep.
Yeah, my group is more on the path planning, so I can begin.
Path planning is a big deal. I think it's going to be really bigger.
Mm-hmm. And Uli comes from the systems.
Kind of more resource management. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the API, can you shut down stuff? Or can you only say left, right, or can you say wait a second?
We can shut it down.
No, I mean specific sensors. So
we
say,
think,
okay, I run low on battery, I know I'm running low on battery,
right.
I don't want to have this and this, I'd rather have this than that.
We tried to get a clear answer to that question because we're interested in it, and we know we can cut down the data stream from the sensor, but I don't know if
the
I can shut it down. I don't know if I can shut down the sensor completely. I know I can cut off the stream, the data stream from it. That's what they call shutting it off. I think it might still be running. But that's something we can explore. And real time, like getting payload control for the side scan sonar would be really interesting to me. Right now, the side scan sonar lives on a separate hard drive from the other sensor data, but it's accessed by FTP. But we could, for instance, have MATLAB running on the guest computer, processing, you know, accessing that through the VIP, getting.
What do you consider? What's VIP? Oh, no.
The virtual interface program. So it could build, so it's coming in line and line at a time. To build a tile that you assemble, but you could look at a tile or you could look at potentially your reverberational characteristics. I don't know if that's available. I think that's simply the pixel density as it's coming in. Or you wait till you have a picture, and from a picture you can do classifications like we did with the rays. And then you could say, okay, there's an object of interest and turn the vehicle around to get a look at it. In real time, so you know, before you even know it did it.
So basically,
very similar to what the tags.
Basically, down the hall, I have two gliders.
Right. Oh, that's another place we can talk about. You did swarming work.
But there's some of that.
Some, but I mean, this thing, another reason to use it would potentially be vehicle to vehicle, including different vehicle, vehicle to ship, vehicle, AUV to glider, or AUV to AUV, V2V applications.
But tricky part that we did, basically build a whole infrastructure so you can actually put a, we have a small Linux supercomputer in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do, and we have control about everything. But
yeah,
we were lucky in the sense that we were that. The first time when it wasn't bought yet by a defense contractor, Teledyne. So right. Basically we have everything.
Yeah, nice.
So
yeah, so we don't have that everything. We have, you know, the protocol, the recon protocol that allows that bridge.
So as long as
but you know, there's only so many things the vehicle can do anyways.
Sure.
And you have control over all those.
Right. And you don't want to do too much because you know,
right.
There are so many safety features that isn't a glider, right. You don't want to touch that. It's layered control what you meant.
Yes.
Right. So basically that's important.
Exactly.
So it looks, from an architecture point of view, it looks pretty much the same. The only interesting, I mean, the difference is that you have 90% on the propeller, leaving 10% to optimize. So from my point of view...
But that 10% is huge, potentially, right?
Sure, but
I
if
mean,
you look
if
at
you
the glider,
a two-hour mission, right,
I have
yeah.
80% to optimize.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's...
But
that's
on the power. But right. But I suspect that the 10 or 20% that's left of the power still is larger...
In
terms of capacity
sure.
than what you have on
sure,
the glider
that
altogether.
True. That is true. But it's a different world.
Yeah.
It's a different.
Yes, it is.
Everything is very.
And the big thing is it's precision. So you can do a lot of things that you can't do with the glider. When the glider pops up to the surface, it downloads the data and somebody says, oh, that's where you are. I want you to turn on a new heading or whatever. This thing, you get it on the bottom. You
no,
can have,
you have
a holding station.
You don't do that anymore. It just reads it.
Oh,
okay. It's totally autonomous.
Ah,
it's just a GPS. So,
But underwater, you can have doing stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Have ADCP running, but you cannot really. It's too expensive.
Too power expensive.
So, I don't know if you want to continue, perhaps a little bit.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Sorry, I'm kneeling here in my back. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. Anybody that's online watching this, thank you also. And let me know. My email is grotus@marine.rutgers.edu. It's GROTHUES.
And also reach out to
yes.
me.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for your attention.